I'll begin with some assignment. In the context of Aristotle, there is this thing. I mean, you can call it as it's called a square of opposition. Okay, so you find out what it is. This is in the context of logic. Square of opposition. This is in the context of logic. So we discussed some principles of logic previously. As I mean, this is all to do with the belief system, the science of belief systems, namely the logic. So in that, when we are talking about the square of belief system, he is talking about, you know, how different kinds of beliefs are there, how they can be classified, and how they can be understood together. So he creates a theoretical grid. So into that grid, all statements must fall. So what you have to do is, you have to understand what this square of opposition is and find out how all propositions that you can create fall under that thing. So you have to write down how it works out with all kinds of propositions. So what are the various kinds of propositions? The propositions can be something like there can be a proposition called something like this. Universal statement. So something would be called a universal statement. So what would be a universal statement?
Sun rises.
If you say sun rises in the east, I mean you have to say it in a proper way. So what you have to do is, if it is a universal statement, okay, you have to qualify. And that's sometimes also called quantification. You also qualify that statement. Something like, sun would always rise in the east. Something like that. So there are some universal statements. So don't confuse universal statements with every law. So universal statements can be of this kind, where you have to say all men are mortal, for example, if I say as simple as that. All birds have feathers. Okay? So when you're saying that all birds are feathers, so significance, of course, here is that in the word all. Okay, so the statements which can have something like it's about, that means whatever you are asserting is about every instance of that class. So you're making an assertion, you're applying some predicate to every element in the class. And when you say something like that, you call it as a universal statement. There are sometimes other kinds of statements which are called, which use another qualification called sum. Now, what would sum statement, you can think of an example like that. Some men are wise. I mean, obviously every man is not wise. Okay, so you can actually use some such examples like that. So while mortality is a character of every man or every being out there, but some mortals, okay, are wise. Okay, so in that sense you can make out or you can also make that, you can also use some things of that kind. Out of a combination of this, you can actually build out a kind of a matrix where you can also say something like this. Most. Like you can say, most men are mad. You know, you may be able to give some such statement. So these are the ways in which Aristotle classifies different kinds of propositions. And then finally he creates a beautiful grid. Do you remember the grid that I have shown you about Empedocles? You know, like you have those four elements and then the four qualities of a position, and then various permutations and combinations that are possible in that whole grid, and produces all possible things that can exist. In a similar way, Aristotle did exactly a similar kind of attempt for the belief system. So for the world out there, Empedocles gave such a grid, and that grid of course is also there on the, and I've also that PDF file is already uploaded, so you can also have access to the book. Have you, any of you downloaded the book from the site? The book is uploaded on the site under the term, I think, resources. So if you go to resources, you will find a book which you can download, and so some of the pictures and the entire exhibition is there. You can read the exhibition from there. And so this is another such grid. So I am leaving it to you as an exercise. So what you have to do is to find out what is this thing called, this is a square of opposition. So you just type square of opposition in any on a search engine, then you will find a lot of arguments. So read a few of them. One or two articles, if you read, you get a clear understanding about what it is. And then you will have to write a small small note on that, and then submit it to me. All right, so that's your assignment. So now, we have, you see, because the Plato and Aristotle did so many things that it's difficult to cover every one of them. Something that you possibly should know about these two people, apart from the distinctions that we have been talking about both Aristotle and Plato. Plato had he fell in love with mathematics. I mean, that may be the best way of describing that person. And then he has started an academy called the Plato's Academy. I mean, we call it Plato's Academy. At that time, he called it just an academy. And these were the early, you know, schools or places, you know, where people used to come together and discuss a lot of things. And there was a big Michelangelo's painting about Plato's Academy. And he did a lot of them on several buildings in ancient Greece. So he used to say that on the academy there is a banner which says, we have our schools, you know, if you don't pay fees, you can't enter into the school. Right? Like if you want to go to a college, like for example, you want to join CBS, I mean, you have to pass through an exam, and you should already have 10 plus 2 passed, and then you can get into this thing. So similarly, there are some qualifying exam to enter into the academy. And that was, if you don't know mathematics, don't enter into the academy. So that was like, so the people who are ignorant about mathematics cannot get into Plato's academy. So that was like a prerequisite. So if you don't know mathematics, you can't be my student. So he was so interested in mathematics. Anyway, that is an aside. Basically, I wanted to tell you because that clearly distinguishes Aristotle from Plato. Of course, Aristotle knew mathematics. Therefore, he was somebody who entered into the academy, spent several years, and slowly he developed ideas which are different from Plato. And then he formed another school, and it wasn't academy, and that's called Lyceum. So Plato's school was academy, and Aristotle's school was called Lyceum. I am not very sure whether it is E or I. Pardon? Lyceum, Lyceum. It's the name of the school. I mean, don't ask me what's in a name. The two names. You can say the two names are not different. They are different schools. I think it's possibly Lyceum. I exactly do not know. Academy may have some kind of meaning attached to it. But possibly Lyceum is the name of the place or something like that. I don't know.
Yeah,
Aristotle school. Well, I mean, these are simple some of these facts that you get to know. Of course, Lysim didn't have any such rules. I mean, he was much more open. He had the courage to discuss a lot of mundane things. And Aristotle was kind of an encyclopedic scholar. He did lots and lots of things. So it's very difficult for us to actually, in fact, a lot of historians doubt that is it one person or a set of people. Because the amount of books and amount of things that he has written about various subjects, you know, give you the kind of thing that he did something impossible. And what was he doing? Because he wasn't seen always writing. Even if he were to write so many things, I don't think he would be doing anything. I mean, the amount of volumes that he has been written. So that's why what people thought is that it's possibly not the entire achievement of one person. It's possibly a group of people in Lyceum, you know, who might have written and put together all these things, and everything is being named after Aristotle, which is very likely the case. Another important thing that you must know is that none of the things that we have been talking about so far are actually been written by Aristotle or Plato. Why? Because most of what they have written have gone to the library in Alexandria, like from Academy to Lyceum and also to various other places. You know, it is not like a culture where they just kept on, you know, verbal it's not a place where they just passed on to the children, the students, and then students have to remember them and then they have been passed on. So that's not kind of a oral culture. So the Greeks fortunately have a written culture. They used to write down things. They used to have large scrolls and all those things. Like each book is a scroll. There is a picture of Alexandria also in the exhibition. If you look at it, you'll get to see. Like each book is like a scroll. And those scrolls were all there in the library of Alexandria. And of course, some of you know that the Romans have burnt the library. And but at that time, what happened is some of the people who were working in the library, what they did, they managed to collect whatever they could collect from that library and fled to wherever they could go. And most of them landed in Arabia because that was a safer place at that time for this kind of an activity. And so what they did, they took all these manuscripts. They fled away from the thing, and a lot of things got burnt up, so we don't know what they are. But most people, all those things, when they got back, what the Arabians did, they have read them, and they translated them, they wrote them in their own way, and they wrote commentaries on them. And so, whatever we have today, you may go and see, like for example, Plato's dialogues in Greek. But that Greek is not what Plato wrote. You may see Aristotle's textbooks like Posterior Analytics, Metaphysics, Physics, Argonon, and so many other books that Aristotle has written. But those books were actually the ones that are passed on to us from Arabic scholars. So Arabic scholars wrote them, and then what happened was that around 11th century onwards, they were translated back to Latin and then to Greek. As you can imagine, you know, that whole transfer and the translations happened in so much of time, and it passed on to so many hands. So we really do not know what we know about that period is actually authentic, because so much of changes might have happened during the whole process. In any case, so whenever you have to read history, I mean, you always have to add a lot of pinch of salt, and you should have some kind of interpretation. So you may not believe that, okay, this was what Aristotle did. But then they had very clear characteristic things. Like in Academy, whatever Plato did, you know, he wrote it as dialogues. And whereas whatever Aristotle did, he wrote, you know, beautiful prose. I mean, I'm calling it beautiful prose because his books are very well structured. I mean, you'll see the architectural beauty in the way how the whole book is structured. You know, he used to systematically divided everything into chapters, sub-chapters and things like that, with numbered propositions, and used to build the whole argument one after the other. So, if you have a chance, you can spend some time. I mean, we have all those books here. We have, of course, we don't have the Latin books or the Arabic books, but we have the English translations of both Plato's dialogues. The complete compendium of Plato's dialogues we have. We also have Aristotle's works. So just have a look at it. Just turn a few pages and get a feel about what kind of language they used, how they have done their job. I mean, because of the kind of things that they have done, it's simply impossible for us to discuss everything. So I have just picked up a few things. Some of the things I already told you in the past lectures. So let us discuss a little bit about one of the widely known theories of Aristotle, and that's about causes, because Aristotle did a lot of work on ontology of the world. I mean, about the things, he has done work on categories, like he has worked out what kind of categories of things exist, like categories of things that exist. And similarly, what he has done is also worked out a kind of a science, and in that one of the important factors is that you have to find out, for any object that you want to know about, you have to find out the four causes of that object. I mean, some of the causes may not be applicable to it, but then if whenever you have to ask, you have to ask four things about that thing. So whenever you ask for an explanation, you have to give explanation in terms of, by giving a cause of that event or object or whatever. So in that sense, he divided the causes. There are four causes to it. One of the things is called material cause. In the sense, for example, let us take the chalk as an object. So if Aristotle were to do a science of chalk, how would he do it? Okay, so then you have the other things, like for example, formal, and then you have efficient, and the last one is the final. So there are four causes. So for everything you have to, that is, in other words, he is almost telling you that if you want to characterize something, you characterize them on the basis of these four. So given a thing to you, so he tells you how to characterize that thing. So let's characterize the chalk as the object. I mean, I am not telling you that Aristotle wrote about chalk. But, you know, just as Plato didn't do anything about the word, I mean, we took word as an example to talk about it. So let's, what is the material cause of this chalk? Suppose if you have to ask this question. Of course, these are all about causes. So what is the material cause of this chalk? So what is a material cause? A material cause is about what is the substance with which a thing is made of. So when you ask this question about what is the substance with which a thing is made of, and that substance becomes the cause of that thing. So, and that cause is called the material cause. So what is the cause of a chalk? Well, I mean, that's your thing. I mean, you can say whatever it is. So whatever that substance be, you know, whether it's calcium carbonate, or it's not necessary that all chalks have to be made of calcium carbonate. Because if you come to my computer lab, I have a whiteboard, and that the chalk doesn't exist, and that was another thing that was made of something else. That's a whiteboard, and I use a marker, whiteboard marker, to write on. But then that's not a chalk. Okay, that's not a chalk. So these are the problems about. So what is a chalk? Is chalk a writing instrument? Or anything you want, call it a chalk? Should it be white? Why? Because of course, I mean, you may sometimes find colorful chalks out there. So these are the issues that will keep on coming when you are discussing about those things. And while you are doing that, you also have very important distinction, which is also Aristotle. What he does, he distinguishes the properties.
Like you can, these are the distinctions of the properties. And these properties are distinguished by Aristotle as what is called accidental and essential.
And this relates to some of the things that we discussed earlier in the logic. I'll come to that. So that is to say that what is the accidental property of this chalk? That it is white. In the sense that, you know, that a chalk need not be white. It can be some other color. So that becomes an accidental property of the chalk. What is the essential property of the chalk? I can get some other chalk. Like, for example, I don't know, because none of you have actually used. In my childhood, I have used what is called a slate. On that slate, we are not given chalks. Sometimes we used to write with a chalk, but you know, chalks are very expensive for us. So we used to write with special kinds of soft stone. A very special stone used to be there. And we used to get, you know, pieces of that. And then, so there are varieties of chalk. And therefore, every chalk is not made of the same substance. So substance is not possibly what is essential about a chalk. Because now, what defines what can go inside actually depends on, for example, what is it meant for? It's supposed to write. It's supposed to write. And therefore, you know, so if writing is something that defines what a writing instrument should be, and chalk is one kind of a writing instrument, and therefore, so to write is the most important characteristic feature of a chalk. And therefore, when it comes to the chalk, you know, the final cause is more important. The final cause means, what is it meant for? What is its function? What is its role in the plethora of things? So whenever you are discussing final cause, you have to look at it from the point of view of what is the role of that thing in the entire system. Something like that. Let's look at the other issues also. Now, what is the formal cause of a chalk? So, what the meaning of a formal would here mean that what is the shape or what is the formal aspects of that thing? So, when you are talking about form, you mean the shape of the thing. Because there should be something like, you know, a kind of a, you can say, a design. I mean, the best term that comes to my mind to explain what is the meaning of a formal cause means the design of that material. So you can say formal cause is essentially the design of a chalk. So for example, it may be, you know, suppose if I give you a chalk, but suppose I can also possibly give you something like this. This is, I mean, a bad drawing of a cylinder. So these both are cylinders. So I give you this. Possibly what you would do, if I ask you to write with this, you know, what you would possibly do is, you would hold it as if like a coin, and possibly write from the edge, rather than from the end of this. So it depends on how the form should be. What is the design of that chalk? And then you have to ask, is it the design that makes it a chalk? Or is it the substance that makes it a chalk? Or is it the purpose that makes it a chalk? So this is how you have to analyze the world around. So this is how he used to conduct his inquiry. So his inquiry has a beautiful structure. I mean, if you start reading Aristotle, you'll be wondering, I mean, how come all of us are so ignorant? Why we haven't learned this in our school? because each of us will get so much of analytical abilities and thinking abilities and argument abilities and, you know, doing proper inferences and things like that the moment you start reading any of those texts. And now, what would be an efficient? So you understood about the design. What we'll do is we'll take another example other than the chalk later. After we work out exactly, we understand what they are, and then we take another example so that we get an kind of a picture about it. What is an efficient cause? Now, an efficient cause is something about here. Efficiency doesn't mean efficiency of it is one. Efficient cause here means agency. So, remember, we're talking about agency here. That is, who made it? So is there a cause? That is, it exists because of someone. Like for example, if you have honey. Honey exists because of honeybees. So honey, what is the cause of honey? Honey may have other causes as well. But honey certainly has an efficient cause. So honey has an efficient cause because bees are the agents which produce that honey. So what about this one? So this is also produced in this particular form. It is available in this particular form because somebody designed it that way, and somebody manufactured it that way, somebody fabricated it that way. So there is an agency, that is, there is a cause of who made it, the manufacturer. So a manufacturer is also a cause of the existence of this. So manufacturer becomes an agency of that. And if you actually look at it, this is complete science. I mean, it is almost like, you know, he looks at the whole category and he classified all these categories so beautifully. And I already told you what is a final thing. That is, in a sense, you know, you can look at it like this, role, function, or what is this also called, the end. That's why it's called the final. What is its purpose? Purpose is always, you know, so why is it there? Because its purpose is this. Because it performs that function. So sometimes what happens, its end might determine, okay, the design as well. That is the formal cause, okay, that is what kind of a design you want to apply might depend on what is the function of that object. So that way there could be an interrelationship of this. So it is not necessary that whenever you are discussing something, it is not the kind of thing that you may be doing. Let us take another example and work out the entire story again. Let's take this time something called a house. Okay, now let's look at what is the material cause of a house.
Bricks,
cement. But I have built a house in my village using
straws.
Not bricks.
Straws.
We have used cut
trees.
We dried them, you know, put them all together and weaved them with also organic thread and made a kind of a wall. And on top of that we have put wet mud with a lot of gobar mixed in it, and we created a wall out of it. This is how, if you go to a tribal village, you will see this kind of houses are also made. So then the question, why is he asking this? Is something a house because it is made of that material? So when you have to analyze that substance, you will actually understand sometimes material cause is not the essence of that concept of a house. So a something is a house because of its form. Why? Because you can make a house of so many things. Sometimes, for example, you may be able to describe like, okay, house is supposed to be like this. I mean, you can see that this is our nursery drawing of a house. But that's not the house of a bird. Bird's nest, for example, is not like this. I mean, it is the other way around. It's as if, you know, you put the house upside down and that becomes like a nest of that. I mean, that's because they fly. So they want an upside down house. Okay, so anyway, so the point here is that, so that becomes the formal cause of that. So you could possibly make a house with plastic. I mean, there are plastic houses. Like for example, when suddenly you have to build a big Olympiad kind of city, you know, people have actually built, you know, plastic walls, plastic doors and things like that, and suddenly built a hotel out there, and then they dismantled after some time. So you sometimes you see that kind of ship, and suppose when there is there are these earthquake that happened, for example, in Maharashtra. What was that place? Latur. So there, you know, sometimes people have donated such plastic houses to immediately build houses out there. Of course, I mean, you can build houses with wood, of course. You can build, so brick is not the only thing. Because we are living in an urban area where, you know, we build it with bricks. So as soon as I say what is the material cause, you would immediately think of, you know, bricks and cement and things like that. But brick and cement is not the main thing. The main thing of a house is in the design, and also the design conditioned by what is it meant for. Okay, so therefore you need to have, you know, some kind of a floor space, some kind of a ceiling. So you expect two important things out there, and you expect some kind of partition, and therefore some kind of a separation, therefore you expect some walls. And when you are talking about this, what are you doing? You are putting a ceiling, a floor and a wall in a particular order. And that order is what we call the formal cause. The way you arrange the given things. And that is, in a sense, the essence of what a house is. I mean, if you explain those things. What about the efficiency? Efficient cause of a house, the builder of the house. It can be many number of people. So there is an agency about building the house. So in the whole process, of course, Aristotle also discusses where is the design when a person is building it. So he says that the agent has the formal cause in the head, and he uses the formal cause while he is shaping it up. So if you don't have the formal cause in the head, possibly, you know, instead of making a house, you would possibly be collecting everything and put a kind of a, you know, collect everything, and then, so for example, you build all the building material. You can very clearly see that happening when you visit a building material place. So some construction is happening, and when you go there, you know, there will be pounds of sand and, you know, a lot of bricks out there and things like that, and that doesn't actually constitute the house. Unless they are put together in a particular way, it doesn't become a house. And so that is what is called the formal cause, and then the efficient cause. And of course, there is a purpose behind this whole process. So like that, you can discuss just about anything in the world, including yourself. So let us construct for yourself. What is the material cause, the formal cause, the efficient cause, the final cause? So construct yourself. So what is the material cause of you? Maybe it should be made of cells. It should be made of living material. So the living material becomes your material cause. So you should not have wood in your body. But wood may also at one time may have a living material in it. Or you can't make it out of cement. So this is how you should be discussing this. And then you should be talking about the formal cause. Is there a design in your body?
Yes.
Or just about anything will do? Now if you are really talking about a material cause of, you know, that your body should be made of something. Now what I will do, I will replace your heart and put a plastic heart. Is it possible? It's possible. We have artificial hearts which are made of mostly plastic. And of course, it's a pump, there will be a motor, there will be some kind of mechanical motor, and there will be some small computer or a chip or something like that which controls the behavior of that. And there will be a pacemaker, there will be current, there will be everything. So finally, you create a kind of a nice electronic gadget or electrical mechanical gadget, and a very complex one. And such hearts are transplanted. Now the question therefore is, if you say that you should be made of flesh, and if flesh is the material cause of your body, then what about this transplantation? That's not transplanted with flesh. So therefore the question arises, is flesh really the material cause of your human body? And then comes an important thing. I mean, you can still be an Aristotelian and say that, no, the heart need not be made out of flesh. It is made, that means it should have only a formal cause. That means it should have a design based on its role in the body. Once you understand the role of heart, what you can do is, you can substitute it with anything that can perform that role. So if you know that heart is a pump, and a pump that has a rhythmic pumping behavior, so all that you have to do is fabricate a rhythmic pumping behavior, you know, which beats something like 72 times every minute, and then transplant it and put it in the body by using the thing. So that means it should be performing this role of pumping. So pumping blood is its formal final cause. Once the role is understood, then what you can do is you create a kind of a design. So formal and final is the most important thing. That is the essence of heart. Possibly efficient agency is not important. I mean, it can be imported or made in some other laboratory, or you can possibly fabricate in your lab, as long as it satisfies these two requirements. You know, you don't have to really worry about the efficiency of it. And the material can be just about anything. But you may be able to do that for a few of your parts. But there may be certain parts of your body which may not be able to be transplanted like that. So, what is interesting here is the way how Aristotle thinks about the world. He thinks about the world in this way. He looks at everything about the world and finds out what are the joints and what are the bones of everything that exists out there. He saw what can be replaced, what cannot be replaced. What is essential and what is accidental of every substance. Every event, every function, everything out there. And therefore, though a lot of people, I mean, still say that, you know, Aristotle has not been scientific because, you know, he thought that, you know, bodies fall because, you know, they wanted to fall. Because, I mean, he did say certain things like that. But then as we have seen, it is not that straightforward. Last time we saw how beautiful was Aristotle's description of how a fall happens. So it was not such a, you know, what you can say, a foolish statement. That statement was not so foolish. It was a profound description because he had a particular form, a design of the universe. And based on that, he made that statement of whatever statement he did. And he wanted to explain that event based on the form. And so if you start looking at this way, you will actually understand how beautiful was his mind. He has sort of constructed the whole ontology or the way how the world is divided, and then he wanted to describe the behavior of how things are made. So if you start looking at it, this is still quite relevant for us, even to understand exactly how you have to look at the world out there. I mean, if you today look at the complex systems, the science of complex systems today, you know, complex systems today still considers these two things very, very important. The theory of complex systems, for example, cannot, you know, eliminate the final cause from the picture. Because the role that a part plays in a whole is very important. If you don't keep that, you can't build a complex system ever. All mechanical engineers would understand how important a part is. In fact, if you go to any mechanical streets in Mumbai, I don't know how many of you actually visit. There are very specialized streets. You go to one street, you'll get nothing but screwdriver in that road. Have you visited any of those streets? You should visit. Not just Lamington Road, the Princess Street, Lamington Road, and you go to all those places. You go to one road, you'll get only microscopes in that road. You go to another road, you know, you get screwdrivers and rods and things like that. You go to another road, you get only carburetors. These are called the parts. Of course, some of them are new, some of them are old, some of them are disgruntled, you know, put them out together. So, all these things, you know, why are they there? That is because these are different things and they are not made always of the same material. So, which essentially means that the material cause of that thing doesn't really matter. All that matters is you have to replace it. As you can see, there are so many taxis in Mumbai. And none of these taxes are actually having the same part that was actually come at the time when it was made, because some of them are 30 years old, some of them are 40 years old. So the engine that it has today is not the engine that it was born with. So you replace the engine, but it still functions out there. So therefore, what part should go where, and how do you understand that particular fabrication? You know, all that means that, you know, people still use them intuitively and sometimes quite explicitly, all these things, and this is the way how a lot of people think. Particularly engineers use this particular logic almost, you know, left, right and center. So in that sense, this particular beautiful way of talking about these various causes is still quite live, but we don't acknowledge that we are actually following Aristotle's way of thinking. I mean, Aristotle's way of thinking, of course, went on for quite some time in this way. Anyway, so this is just a kind of a brief orientation about how Aristotle thought about the world. And of course, he has made this important distinction between, you know, accidental properties of an object and then essential features of an object. So before we close this discussion, let us at least have some examples of this. Like, how does he make these distinctions between accidental and essential? So you would be saying something like this: if something is an animal, okay, what should be the essence of it? So that means vitality, for example. Okay, should be its essence. If vitality is removed, then it's no longer an animal. Then what will be? What will it be? It can be earth. So as soon as you remove vitality, it is one of the parts of the earth. It becomes like a, or maybe you take away vitality, you take away its properties about being matter or something like that, then of course it would be nothing. So that's how, you know, he characterizes various things. So everywhere he talks about these things. For example, if I describe the various accidental and essential features about, for example, all of us, like all of us are human beings, but then there are some accidental features about us. What are they? What are the accidental things that each of us have? Essentially, all of us are. Like for example, the hair is one example. Like for example, okay, I suppose tomorrow I come shaved. Okay, then I mean, do you say that, okay, this guy is not Nagarjuna anymore? You won't say that. You would recognize me. Why? Because of my essence. That means my I would still call me. Like, so suppose tomorrow I won't come with this kurta anymore. Maybe I would come with a different shirt of a different color or something like that. So these are the accidental things about me. Or even if tomorrow I will stop speaking in English and I will, for example, speak in my mother tongue, Telugu, then even then I would still be myself. So even those things are still accidental. So it's not necessary that I must be speaking that language as a human being. I may be speaking some other language. So that is how, if you start looking at it, it's a very important analytical tool. Whenever you discuss things, you always have to distinguish what is accidental and what is incidental. And sometimes you may be thinking that accidental things are not important. No, sometimes you have to explain accidental things also. That is to say, how something gets this property. Is it because of an accident, or is it because of its very nature, that it is made like that and that is why it is behaving like that? Or is it like this because of an accident? So this is the way how, you know, Aristotle used to work out these things. And another important thing which might be of very, which might come out to be of very good use for your guest lecture on 11th, the next week, is another interesting methodology that the Greeks have invented. Of course, I wouldn't say Greeks because it has been used by a lot of traditions. But Greeks, you can say, have sort of cherished it, lived with it, and amplified it, I should say. They amplified it so much that it has no point of return. It never returned back. And that's actually one of the reasons why a lot of people who looked at the beauty of the Greek science still appreciate it for this reason. And so I've talked about certain things which have never returned back. For example, the distinction that we have discussed between types and tokens, or between the genus and species, the logic that of Aristotle, you know, we continuously use them, and they are all part and parcel of our life today. Similarly, there is very important thing, and we also discussed earlier about the law of conservation, for example, as Thales has stated it, which made this entire enterprise and the whole discourse possible. Similarly, there is another such very important principle which Greeks have given it to us, and that method still is followed in science, and that is used in very different names. This is called the method of analysis and synthesis. This method of analysis and synthesis can be formulated in so many ways. But if you look at almost everything that Greek science did, you know, they also used to explicitly say that this is what we are doing. If you do this, then it is scientific. If you are not doing this, then it's not science. That means if you are conducting any inquiry, the inquiry should have an analytical move and a synthetic move in the whole thing. And that is what gives the science a scientific character. We'll take a few examples to understand how this analysis and synthesis actually happens. A lot of examples may be taken, but let's take up some simple example like this. Suppose I have an irregular polygon. It can be irregular in the sense that sides are not equal or something like this. Now this is the problem now we have to solve using this method of analysis and synthesis. Now what is it that you have to solve? Maybe you have to calculate its area. Now it's irregular. And of course, if it was a perfect square, or even if it is not a square or a rectangle, what would you do?
Divide it into triangles.
You would divide it into triangle? No. And then do what?
Now let's
take this, and we'll come to that problem a little later. This is very interesting. So let's look at this. If I have something like this, should I divide it into a triangle?
No.
Now the question here is that what is it that you know best? A rectangle.
Square.
Or even a square. Now why do you know a rectangle better? Because all that you have to know is that you multiply the length of the width and the length. So given that known thing that you can multiply the length and this one, you will be able to get the entire thing. And then if you really have to understand how much is this, you possibly have to make half of that. And then say this, so given any triangle, whatever the triangle be, all that you do is, instead of finding out directly what is its area, you can find out indirectly what is its area. All that you do is find out of which rectangle it is a half of. You can do that. And this is called the method of analysis and synthesis. Or it's also, in a much more easier way to understand, it's also called, you know, reducing the unknown to a known quantity. So what is the known here? Rectangle is the known. You know the rectangle area. What is unknown? The triangle. Now I am giving you this problem. Now how are we to do this?
Divide into smaller rectangles.
So what you can do is, you can divide this one entirely into a large number of rectangles and start solving this whole problem. Now you may be wondering that this is something like a Greek thing. No, this is how all cultures all over the world have solved the problem of land. Given a land, you know, how do you measure the land? Because the land always doesn't come as rectangles or squares or whatever. The land is quite irregular. Even, for example, the plot that we have in the Homi Bhabha Center is not a regular rectangle. So, how do you do this? So, all that you have to do is, you can very clearly do, everyone does that. So then, in what sense we are saying that this method is very, very Greek? Everybody used it. But then Greeks didn't just use it. They used it. And one of the interesting properties about the Greek science is also a hallmark of science, and that is, you also formulate it. Using by a tradition is one thing, and formulating it and following it is another. And understanding this distinction is very, very important. If you ever want to do science, okay, just doing it is not enough. If you just do it, I mean, like so many people do it. Lot of engineers are there who can fabricate wonderful instruments and things like that, but they may not know the science behind it. They may be able to do out the thing, still it falls down. Sometimes you may actually have to understand it. And that's exactly the place where this whole thing comes. The Greeks not only used this principle that almost every culture has been doing it, but what they did is, they found out exactly where are the joints of this thinking. They formulated it, and they called it the method of analysis and synthesis. And then they say that, find out what you know to begin with. So you define, for example, what a rectangle is. It's easy to define what a rectangle is. And then use the knowledge of rectangle to solve the problem of triangle. Use the problem of triangle and rectangle, and then solve the problem of something like this. Suppose, having solved the triangle and the rectangle already, now all that possibly I have to do is, you know, divide it into either rectangles and solids. Now that I already know that this can be divided, that is, it can be analyzed into two knowns. One is known, this one. The other thing that I know is the triangle. So now I know that given any area that you have, I can easily calculate whatever be the area, whatever be the shape, I can always do it like this. And this is in fact the most important explicit, that is very important, explicit tradition of Greek. Now why is the Greeks explicit? Because they formulated it. There is a difference between implicit traditions. There are a lot of people who have used this tradition without explicitly stating, okay, this is exactly what I am doing. This is how you should do it. These are the rules of doing it. So they used to first formulate the rules and then give you a problem, and then what you have to do is, you have to solve that problem using these formulations only and not using anything else. And that is how, you know, the entire Greek tradition. So the reason why Greek tradition is applauded today so much is because of this. Okay, so having said this, I have used some of these things, like, you know, explicit, and also used the term formulation. Now if you don't do this, you are not doing science. So you may be very systematic in thinking, but you haven't formulated the things properly, you are not explicit, made everything explicit, you are possibly not doing science. There are very few exceptions sometimes. Take for example someone like Ramanujan. He is a great mathematician. Okay, he hasn't done everything explicit. He gives you a rule, or he gives you a result, or he states a theorem. He doesn't even sometimes tell that it's a theorem or an axiom or whatever. He just writes some proposition in his notebook. Now other mathematicians will find out the explicit formulation of that. How to prove it, how to derive it, how to make it explicit. Now if you don't do that, you know, just making intuitive wise statements doesn't make somebody a scientist. So if you want to practice science, you have to work out how, you know, these things have to be stated and from what follows what. So you have to show deductively, you have to prove the relationships between the propositions and so on and so forth. So that is how, when you go to the next lecture, I mean, you would also be able to see and appreciate that this particular method of reducing, okay, unknown to a known thing becomes like a hallmark of something like science. And, you know, if you for example see if you see the various Greek texts, particularly in mathematics, you know, this is a riddle. I mean, so beautiful, circle. Circle is a riddle. Now, how do you solve this? Is circle something that is known to you? What is known to you? Maybe rectangle is known to you. Or what is known to you is just the length. Length is known to you because of this. Or you take a rope. Just take a length of rope because that's how people used to measure long things. Or a tape. Tape is also like a rope. Or you take a rod and then you talk about it. Now, what I have is a rod. Rod is what I have in my hand. Now, how do I solve this circle using a rod? Is it possible to solve? With a rope, how do you solve this? Yeah, so the point here is that all that you possibly will do is, suppose if I were to ask, measure the circumference of the circle. Now the people who measured the circumference of the circle didn't use the formula to begin with. The formula was derived later. So what they did, they took a rope or a thread or whatever and turned it around the circle. And then spread it together and put it on a measure of a rod or something like that. And then said, this is this many rods length. It could be foot, it could be a meter scale or whatever that measure be. That's arbitrary. Because the units are arbitrary. What is not arbitrary is how you measure the length. So that is the reason why, even though it is round, you know, we reduce the circumference into a linear measure. Because length is a linear measure. Because linear measure is what is known to us. So ultimately what you have to do is that an unknown measure like a circle or the length of a circle has to be reduced to a linear measure that we know about, like a rod. So this is what is the beauty of the Greek method. So the Greeks have stated how you can reduce an unknown to a known. And they did that meticulously in every domain that they have. Whatever they have, they always used to reduce the unknown to the known. So this is what you call the analysis. And what is analysis and synthesis about it? So what do you analyze? An unknown is analyzed into a known part of it. So find out, given any unknown thing, given any unknown that are given any problem, find out what is known in that problem to begin with. And then use those knowns to synthesize the unknown. So you start with the part, and the part is known to you. And therefore, try to construct. Construction is the synthesis that you are talking about. So these are the two most prolific intellectual movements, whether in logic or in thought or in actual practice. You know, if you are an engineer or a mathematician or a logician or a thinker, you will always be doing this analysis and synthesis. In fact, if you talk about, for example, Euclid. I mean, Euclid's text also has some descriptions about, you know, the whole method that he follows. If you have read Archimedes, even Archimedes also explicitly states the method that he is following. He says, this is the method I am following. This is what I am doing. And then he does and writes a book on principles of mechanics. So if you actually, and there is a greatest distinction between the science that we are doing today and the science that they did at that time. And what is the distinction? When Archimedes wrote, for example, the principles of mechanics, he started with all the principles of mechanics, and then there is an important chapter at the end, the method that he followed. And in today's books, the method is not part of that science. We only tell people how to perform. We don't tell what rules you are following for performing them. So that separation took place, and that's why you have this separation between philosophy, logic, mathematics, science and things like that. We've been talking more about specialized disciplines. So maybe what we are also doing is, we are also analyzing and, you know, separating it out into different compartments, because so many people have to do it, different people have different abilities, and so we don't have to depend on it. But at the same time, if you really ever want to have a kind of an overall picture, and this is what you get. So that's why, you know, reading the ancient works will give you this kind of tradition. I would certainly recommend you to read whenever you have time. So many things. So for example, you could read Plato's dialogues, you could read Aristotle's books, or you can also read Archimedes, who has written so many things. And I'm sure in the next class, Dr. Subramanian is going to tell you about not only the works that both Euclid and Archimedes have written. You'd be able to appreciate all those things. It's very unlikely that I would be there in the next class. So there is a possibility I may just come in, depends on how my appointments go, but I won't be able to come. So next class would be on Euclid and Archimedes, and that's the Alexandrian thing. So with that, we will stop doing the Greek signs. That doesn't mean there is nothing. Like for example, I haven't done any discussion about Heraclitus. Okay, there are so many other people. For example, Galen was a fantastic biologist,
yes,
who did enormous amount of work. There are the Theophrastus, who did a lot of botany. You know, and then there were the famous doctor. Who is that? Hippocrates. Okay, now Hippocrates was like you know, the father of you know, the whole medicine in their school, in their tradition. Like we have our Ayurvedic you know, texts. Like Hippocrates wrote fantastic documents out there, and you have Ptolemy. He did a lot of astronomy and things like that. So we haven't covered a lot of Greek science as yet, but I've just given you some glimpses of the kind of achievements, and I particularly chose those which we still use today. And if you actually look at the structure of the lectures that I did, in almost everything that we did, I have identified those which we still use implicitly in most of the science that we do today. Okay, we'll stop here. And of course, all of you shouldn't forget, we have an assignment today, and of course I will upload that assignment, all of you, and I haven't receiving any assignment so far. But that's not complete, because how many of you are there? You are 12. But I should actually get 12 for each of the assignments. I haven't got all of them. Okay, so make sure that you get all these assignments. As I already told you, okay, the evaluation of this course doesn't consist only in the mid-sem. Okay, I told you, what is the percent of mid-sem?
20%.
And 40% is for assignments. And another 40%? No. For the questions you ask. If you don't ask questions, you're simply going to be evaluated only for the 60%. Remember. NSEM and mid-sem put together is 20%. Be very clear. I mean, let me put this matter very clear. 40 plus 40 plus 20. I give less credit to the exam that you actually take. I don't care what you remember on that particular day. This is the process. If you are not active and alert, you have to solve the assignments that I give you. I don't give many, unlike other classes. You have only 40% you get from the assignments. 40% for the questions you ask. If you don't ask, you lose 40%. That's a large percent to lose. And I ask you questions, only 20%. Because my questions are useless. But they have only 20% requirement. So this is the pattern of examination that I have chosen, and well, I am the rule maker here, so don't ask me any questions about it. So only question that you can't ask is about this pattern of examination. You can ask any other question that is relevant to this class.
I do not know.